I went in as this clinical emergency doctor, burnt out, dissatisfied with medicine, unsure of what I was doing as a doctor, unsure of my purpose, and very much through a series of flights in Africa, walked away feeling like I suddenly understood this importance of empathy, of caring for people.
Welcome back to the World Extreme Medicine Podcast with myself, Owen Walker. In this episode, we're going to be speaking on delivering healthcare and hope against the odds with Mark David Monk. So what to do is really just dig into Mark's recent book that he's just published called Urgent Calls from Distant Places. So an emergency doctor's notes about life and death on the frontiers of East Africa. So what we're to do in the conversation is just look at Mark's time as a flight surgeon, serving in 11 different East African countries. So some of the challenges he faced, and indeed the challenges in providing medical care to patients suffering from both severe trauma, disease, and a various array of pathology. So Mark was raised in Switzerland and in Canada and began his career as an emergency medicine professor and indeed as a medical director of Qatar's National Ambulance Service. So he advanced through executive roles and indeed served also as a CMO, so Chief Medical Officer for a regional international division of a leading healthcare system. The book is focused on life before this event, so indeed his formative years into flight medicine. And that's what we're going to dig into within the conversation. So welcome, Mark, to the podcast.
Oh, and thanks so much for having me. Terrific to be here.
Mark, I just wonder if we could start by... Indeed, before we just unpack the book, just what led you to Africa and what indeed sort of drove you to a career in emergency medicine?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So the book itself, as you mentioned, Owen, is really about my experiences as a flight doctor with AMREF Flying Doctor Service in Kenya, two trips in 2008 and 2012. And the book really is a discussion of my trajectory, how I became a doctor, and then really how I ended up in Africa, which was for me a really transformative experience. And I think really the core purpose of the book. Listen, I was really had no intentions to become a doctor. I was an awful university student. I was a philosophy and religion major. I had taken zero science classes. But one thing I had done in college was join the local town's volunteer ambulance service. It was almost a fluke. And I think like many of the listeners on this podcast, you get your first taste of EMS. And in many cases, it sets the trajectory for the rest of your life. And that's what happened to me. I became an EMT and an advanced EMT. And one day after a really significant call, there was a cardiac arrest. I was young, right? I was a 20-year-old guy, patches on my arm. Holster with trauma shears in it, very, very, very sincere. There was a remarkable save, and I stood back and had to reevaluate what my life plans were going to be. And I scrapped the concept of journalism school and decided to push hard to get into medical school. And I won't bore you with the details of sort of the intermediary steps, but I ended up fortunately enrolling in a terrific medical school, and then was lucky enough to be accepted to a wonderful emergency medicine program at the University of Pittsburgh, which was at the time still is almost the mecca for thought around pre-hospital care. I went through the whole process. I did my residency, I did fellowship, I worked abroad. And one day when I was a new attending doctor, a consultant, as you say, in the UK, I was looking around the ER and I recognized that I wasn't feeling myself. I felt disengaged. I was abrupt, rude, really not enjoying my job at all. And this was the paradox, Owen, that I had spent all these years trying to achieve this goal of becoming a consultant emergency medicine doctor. And here I was, and I was miserable. And I had to figure out what to do next. I realized in retrospect that this was really, I was burned out, right? This met all the criteria for burnout, depersonalization, anger, irritability. And I realized it was time for a change. And I submitted just on a whim. I knew somebody who'd been in Africa. I submitted on a whim an application to AMREF for their volunteer physician program. And was accepted, and they said, we have an opening in a month or two, can you come on down? And I did. I mean, it was instantaneous decision. I got my Kenyan medical license. I was in Nairobi, done deal. And so the book is really a discussion of my experiences in two tranches of visits to AMREF. And that's really the narrative.
That's fantastic, Mark. And I think it speaks to, like you said, having the versatility and open-mindedness to pivot into a completely different world with a completely different set of challenges, actually. Could you maybe speak to the challenges, just indeed the main themes running through the book, that of maybe the hero's journey, and indeed just the, some of the salient themes that you depict in the book?
Sure. I mean, I think the first one, people often joke about this stereotype of people going to Africa to find themselves, right? It's a meme at this point. I mean, there are hundreds of books written about this idea, but I think there's very much something there. And certainly in my case, my journey was actually a journey far away to discover myself. And I think in many cases, you know, I think the whole key to an authentic life is deeply understanding what motivates you, what's inside, what your key priorities are. And I think certainly in the West, it's very easy to lose sense of who you are and what you're trying to do with your life. And I think one of the reasons these journeys to faraway places really work is it forces you to show up as your genuine self. You're vulnerable. You're very much dependent upon the kindness of strangers. And I think being in an unfamiliar environment really forces you to look deeply inside yourself. And I had this very profound experience in Africa, which was I was flying. I was with people I'd never met before. I was encountering medical situations which were brand new. And I was getting a better sense for what mattered to me. And really what mattered to me was, I realized in hindsight, was empathy. I mean, empathy to me is going to be the secret for longevity in medicine. It is only by having empathy that you can justify the long days and the hard conditions that we tolerate in a medical profession. So this to me was a journey to empathy. And it was interesting. I mean, I started doing some reading, and there have been plenty of people who've had a very similar journey inward. One was Dag Hammarskjöld, the second Secretary General of the United Nations, who wrote just a fantastic collection of essays around his experience working in Africa and looking inside himself, deep spiritual journey. And you asked about the hero's journey. I mean, it's really Joseph Campbell's term. And what he's really talking about is this very archetypal story. It occurs all over the place. Even Star Wars is an example of the hero's journey, but it's the story of somebody who goes to faraway places in a state of crisis, tries to fix them, comes to a solution, and comes back knowing more about him or herself. That's the hero's journey. So that's the book.
Listen, that's fantastic. And I fundamentally agree with that. Having spent time in Nairobi myself, in Kenya, also in Somalia, Mogadishu, and Somaliland in the north, one of the things you just said there, Mark, about understanding the bigger world outside of an emergency department or an ambulance service in a well-established urbanized setting. So the bigger picture and perspective, actually, in that bigger picture, having spent time with people living on $250 a month, working alongside people which are continually being bombed and or shot at on a daily basis, none of which hits the news, and just an absolute deprivation and poverty as well. You're right. It really moves you outside of yourself. Having lived in Nairobi myself, and so I can very much identify with everything you're saying there. My question on the back of that would be, were there times you felt overwhelmed at the challenges that were posed to you?
Yes. Yes. You know, as you're reading the book is a collection of around 20 missions. And as you say, to faraway places. We went to Somalia in some cases. We were in Ethiopia a lot. We went to Tanzania, Uganda, all through East Africa. Small plane Cessnas, and then we did King Airs, and then larger Citation jets for longer distances. And when you do those kinds of missions, these are medevacs, mostly to Nairobi. When you do those missions, it's you, a nurse, and pilots. And you are, in every situation, the only doctor on scene, whether it's to a rural bush rescue, or even when you're flying to pick up people from small community hospitals, they typically are delivered in an ambulance with an attendant, with very limited training, to an airstrip, and then you're picking up these patients. And these are the sick of the sick. And so you're trying to really make order quite quickly. Some of the conditions are odd. I mean, we came across elephantiasis. We had one notable emergency, which we were concerned was potentially a hemorrhagic virus. We were called to the north, and there was a patient there who had been sick for a number of days with fever and dehydration, and a number of other symptoms. But the key issue here was that they basically had lost all clotting factor. I mean, they were starting to bleed from all over the place. And the question that the nurse and I had was, is this a patient who we should be transporting to Nairobi? Because of course, if it's a hemorrhagic virus, I mean, you're importing this lethal virus into a large city. And we weren't, you know, I've never, as a doctor, you're not prepared to make those kinds of decisions. You know, you're not trained to sacrifice one patient to save a larger population of patients. It's not something that ever enters our lexicon. And so we had to make those decisions on scene. And that's, in that particular case, that's when I very much looked to the nurse who was there, who had to make these decisions far more regularly in Africa, because that's what they do. I mean, they see bleeding patients in ERs all the time. So their risk tolerance was far different than mine. And I learned a lot from that discussion. So yes, frequently over my head, to be honest, Owen.
It's really interesting you say that, because I very much did as well. And I think it's a period of growth and indeed resilience, but also flexibility and again, shifting mindsets in the process. Exploration of new frontiers, both within yourself psychologically, but also physically and geographically. Could you speak to, because I think there is a general theme within the book around exploration of new frontiers, and indeed, you know, both clinically exposure to a vast array of pathology, but also just exploration into oneself, your ability, your capability, and your perspective shift. Could you unpack how you translate that in the book?
Sure. The book's title at one point was Frontiers. That's how much it really factors into the story. It follows on Dag Hammarskjöld's book, and he really writes about this concept of having to push yourself to a frontier to look sort of over the edge, but also look back inside yourself. It takes really that push. I think a lot of listeners to this podcast would understand that push. I mean, these are the people who are interested in extreme medicine and going to exotic places understand this concept of going to frontiers to really test yourself, understand what's out there, develop yourself. I wrote about three very interesting frontiers over the course of my life, which I was, some of them having to do with medicine. I mean, one was being a student and being in a trauma room for the first time during a resuscitation. And I remember at that point, the door opening and seeing these critical patients coming in. And it was, I called it a frontier because it was nothing I'd ever seen before. It was only something that those of us in medicine see. And it's such a unique situation that really expands your world in many ways. There were other frontiers in the book as well. One was a very spiritual experience in a mosque in the middle of rural Oman. And then the last was in the book when I was actually caught in a cot market in Nairobi, which was, it kind of popped up in the middle of the night. It turned out that Wilson Airport, where AMREF was based, is the big sort of cot distribution center for a few hours every morning. It's flown in. And cot, for some listeners who don't know, it's a chewable stimulant leaf that's very common in Africa and the Middle East. And that's where the big trade took place. But it was a frontier in the sense that I looked inside and I had no idea what was going on. There were hand signals being used, bartering, negotiations. It was completely foreign to me. But those are the kinds of frontiers I think are so interesting. You expose yourself to those things and you come out a better person.
I agree. It's a sense of otherness, actually. And and like you said, there's a whole trade in cats, and having to deal with it a lot in Somalia, it was very much a diffuse issue. But could you speak to, so there's a couple of themes in the book around corruption. And one of the elements that I definitely had to interface with, both in Nairobi, in Somalia, and in adjacent countries, was the concept of corruption. And, you know, interfacing with that, my stance on that, the corporate stance on that as well. Could you speak to your experience of corruption within the context of East Africa?
Sure. I mean, it's a challenge, right? I think anybody doing business in Africa is confronted with having to deal with requests for money or for bribes. AMRF had a very clear policy that they were not prepared to pay bribes. And I think this was the right approach because at a certain point, people stop asking. It was interesting. I was never fully exposed to bribe paying, but I suspected that some of the money that we were forced to pay in terms of landing fees and other fees were being diverted, and I could never quite prove it. Typically, the way these things work is that somebody will sit on the steps of the airplane and demand that a certain form be filled out with a certain fee before anybody can leave. And, you know, I wasn't quite sure whether this was an official form or not an official form, and I guess nobody would ever know. But I think we were all clear that certainly these were the costs involved in doing business. I mean, in some places, we flew to Berbera, which you may have been to in Somaliland. The landing fees in Berbera were higher than those of Heathrow. I mean, it was extraordinary. And this was an empty landing strip with nothing going on. By the way, one of the world's longest runways, interestingly enough, because it was built by first the Soviets. There was a big Cold War in Africa. And then after that, the Americans came along and used it as a landing zone for the space shuttle, landing strip for emergencies for the space shuttle coming in. And so it was this long runway, but extremely expensive runway. And so, you know, the challenge to all of this ultimately is that this money that you have to pay to get things done, even for humanitarian purposes in Africa, medevac flights, et cetera, becomes a cost that donors bear and that businesses bear. The flip side to this is these people had no other way to make money, right? This was, I don't think this was a well-paying job being a ground attendant, for example, in Berbera Airport. So these are kind of complex things to negotiate. I think, high level, nothing we wanted to pay. Low level, I suspect that was money being diverted, right?
What was your interaction with the US military like out there, Mark? Did you interface with them or indeed interact with them on a regular basis?
Yeah, it was, this was a very interesting experience, Owen. So I had two trips to Africa. The first was in 2008. And I really had no exposure to the American military. We knew that the military were hanging around and they had bases in Africa, but I had never seen them in 2008. And what's interesting in the book is that in many ways there was almost an innocence to the first flights. AMRF, as you know, was founded in the 1950s by three surgeons, two British surgeons and an American, Tom Rees, who founded the Flying Doctor Service. And it was basically a bunch of Cessnas and Pipers, and they would go out into field hospitals and do emergency surgeries. And it was quite remarkable. And it had evolved over the years into this world-class medical repatriation service. I mean, really competing on a global level with any other service. And by 2008, the kinds of flights that we were doing could almost have been done by Tom Rees and the folks in the 1950s. There were traumas and heart attacks and safaris gone wrong. And by 2012, as you may remember, that's when there was the rise of Al-Shabaab and there was a huge Islamic terrorism that had hit East Africa, bombings of malls. The place was on edge. And we were spending a lot of time in Somalia as a consequence flying up. And sorry, Owen, remind me what the question was originally. Oh, the American military. Yes, we're going to have to edit that part out. And so by 2012, it was undeniable that the American military were in East Africa. We knew that they had bases up and down the coast. At one point, we flew into Djibouti, and I could see a stack of drones. That was the American drone base that they were flying over the Middle East and Yemen. Each of them was hundreds of millions of dollars, right? There was billions of dollars of American equipment there. We had one patient who was an American soldier that we took out. It became clear to me that the Americans were there in a counterterrorism capacity. And this was a bit of a challenge because on one level, there's no, you know, I don't want to be Pollyannish about this. On one level, there was a severe security threat in East Africa, and the Americans were the people best equipped to help fight this. Of course, African Union was involved and many others in East Africa as well, the Kenyans pushing back on this. But on the other, I was concerned that there was so much military engagement in Africa and that people at home in the United States seemed to have no idea that this was taking place. If you ask people, are there American soldiers in Africa? Nobody would tell you that there were. And so I was kind of two minds, and I think you'd read that in the book, that on one hand, it's essential work, but on the other, you know, coming through the misadventures in Afghanistan and the misadventures in Iraq in particular, with the American military, I was really crossing my fingers that I could have confidence in the decisions that senior leaders were making in the United States and that this wasn't another folly. And so I was conflicted in the end of the day, but it was eye-opening.
Just as we pivot and just look at your experience with refugee camps, I'm led to believe, and indeed reflecting in the book, you know, your visit to the world's largest refugee camp, what kind of impact did that have on you, Mark?
Oof. This is the final story in the book. And so, as I said, the book is really organized into a series of missions, one after the other. The final trip is a trip into Dadaab, which is in northern Kenya. It's basically top to bottom filled with Somali refugees who were squeezed out because of the political instability in Somalia. And one of the reasons, one of the problems with Dadaab is that it was never really intended to be a long-term refugee camp. There was a hope that this would be a short-term refugee crisis, that the camp would disassemble and people would go home. And indeed, the Kenyans are begging for it to be disassembled and for people to go home, but there's no place for them to go. And so the camp persists. It's, as you fly over it, it's essentially a collection of garbage bags on twigs, forming almost igloo structures. There are a handful of concrete buildings there that have been put up by aid agencies. Different aid agencies have different segments of the camp to manage feeding and medical requirements. But it is a grim place. We flew into the landing strip, which was located in the middle of the refugee camp. And as you looked, there were hundreds of children on the chain link fence, staring at the runway, fingers through the chain link fence, just staring. And just a pervasive sense of listlessness in the place. That and security concerns were extremely high. There'd been bombings and kidnappings that had taken place, so everybody was on edge. And you looked at this place and you just felt there was like no future for these people. The sense of possibility had completely evaporated from the room. And as I wrote in the book, I'm a bit embarrassed to admit, but I just couldn't wait to get the hell out of there, right? I knew I was there to do good work. We were medevacing sick people out of that camp. But there was just such a pervasive sense of misery, and there was so little that I could do as a single doctor in an airplane that I, again, felt overwhelmed and really wanted to just leave. I thought it was a dreadful, dreadful place. And it does raise one of the other themes in the book, which is this sort of concept of, I call it the star thrower, right? And really what that narrative is about is being a single person trying to fix really, really big problems. The reference actually goes back to, you may come across it on LinkedIn, because I think people have co-opted this for like sort of motivational talks at real estate conferences and stuff. But the reference actually goes back to a guy called Loren Isley, who was an anthropologist, who wrote this story of being in a beach house and looking at the beach, and the tide had gone out and there was a veritable holocaust of sea life on the beach. Starfish, fish, jellyfish. I mean, they were all suffocating to death on this tide that had gone out. And as Isley looks out on the beach, he sees that there's this one fellow who's picking up starfish one at a time and throwing them into the water. And he goes up and says, "Why are you throwing starfish back in the water? I mean, this is completely futile, right? This is, there are hundreds of thousands of starfish on this one beach." And the guy looks at him in a paraphrase, basically says, "It matters to that one starfish," right? And so those are the kinds of questions that we had when we were doing these flights into a place like Dadaab, which is that we've spent tens of thousands of dollars in fuel. We have a multi-million dollar aircraft. We've got the world's most advanced ICU care. We've got doctors and nurses here, and we're saving one life, right? And you look around, and there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people in this camp. People who, by the way, have spent their entire lives in that camp. They've never left. I mean, children are born and they've been there 20 years later, are still hanging out. And, you know, it causes you to ask some really deep inner questions, which is this a good use of money? I mean, should we basically just do away with medical evacuation and provide vaccinations, routine antibiotics for these people? What I walked away with is the way I justified it to myself, and I think this still resonates with me, is that it matters for the one starfish, right? If you if you are that one person who's had a heart attack and you're laying in a dusty field someplace in Africa, just the sense of looking and seeing a King Air flying overhead with its landing lights and flashing lights and landing and a well-prepared crew coming out to collect you must be one of the most profound feelings in the world. And so, as I say in the book, I'm not an aid expert. I haven't really dedicated my career to working for these wonderful aid agencies who do just terrific work. I'm very much an amateur. But what I could contribute was my individual skills serving as an emergency physician, one patient at a time. And thus, that's what I did.
I think you said this earlier about learning to pivot and learning to read the times, understand yourself, and know when it's time to shift tact and move on. My question would be, when did you know enough was enough for yourself from working for AMRAF? And then where did you say, right, now it's time to go back to the US, take up a healthcare administrative job, leadership role? What was that point for you, Mark?
Owen, it's an interesting, it's a very important question. And I think one of the other questions that comes up is, why are you writing this book in 2023, right? Because you're writing about stuff in 2008. These are all stories, by the way, that sat on my hard drive and were blog entries and notes, and I needed time to convert them. But one of the reasons I felt strongly about writing this book now is that I look back at AMRAF as one of the key inflection points in my life. That I went in as this clinical emergency doctor, burnt out, dissatisfied with medicine, unsure of what I was doing as a doctor, I'd unsure of my purpose, and very much through a series of flights in Africa, walked away feeling like I suddenly understood this importance of empathy, of caring for people. But I realized I didn't want to do it as an emergency doctor, seeing patients one at a time again. What I wanted to do was to fix the system. What I wanted to do was to get in there and create better systems that would ameliorate much of the pressures that we felt in the emergency room, the flawed payment models, the overcrowding, et cetera. And so really, I went back and dedicated the next 15 years of my career as a healthcare executive, mostly working for startups and interesting businesses that have produced some very interesting models. Very happy to have done them. But this Africa was the inflection point for me. And so thus, that's the reason the book was written.
That's fantastic. And as you said, the hero's journey, there's a lot of self-reflection, self-acknowledgement, and indeed self-improvement from these. And you know, I advocate to everyone I speak to around hospital emergency medicine that there is a lot of deep diving into one's own, because you almost can't gain access until you've been put in some of these situations. You can't gain access into how you are going to react, your emotion, your delayed emotion, but also the ability to overcome, to be versatile, to be open-minded, to learn locus of control as well. But that almost can't be teased out by a textbook. It can't be teased out by a podcast. It can't be teased out by anything else but being in that situation and being subject to some extremely challenging times. And so it's great that semblance comes through, Mark, in the book, and that, you know, you come full circle within that. And that chapter really feeds into where you are now and indeed the positions that you hold now. So it's a fantastic reflection. And I would advocate people to go out and buy and read the book. We will put it into the show notes. And where can people find it? And indeed, we will put links in the show notes, but where can people go out and get the book?
Great, super, Owen. Yeah, so it's the official release will be January 30th, 2024. And you can get it pretty much anywhere. There'll be a Kindle version on Amazon. There'll be hardcover, softcover, pretty much independent. Every independent bookstore will have a copy that you can order, and then we'll have an Audible as well if you like to listen to books on tape. So January 30th would be the big day, but you can pre-order on Kindle today.
Mark, listen, thank you for your time today. I really do appreciate it.
It's terrific. I love being here, Owen. Thanks so much for these insightful questions.
Thanks for listening to the episode. Please feel free to rate, review, and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Please also head over to the World Extreme Medicine website, where you can find more engaging content on extreme medicine webinars and indeed the collection of courses from our global network, including humanitarian, disaster relief, expedition, space, military, tactical, and performance medicine. Thanks again.